don't have to tell you our weather's a little unusual this spring, and maybe this turbulence highlights the importance of resilience. And what are our resilient choices when it comes to gardening? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. It's about planting time and time to talk about gardening. Your participation is welcome at our toll-free number 1-800-478-8255. It's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. We have guests looking to hear your knowledge and share theirs today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The Masters of Public Administration at the University of Alaska Southeast comes to you where you live and work in Alaska and the Yukon Territory. Online classes combine the structure of the classroom with the accessibility of an e-learning program. Get an interactive, supportive, and high-quality education. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, here we are at the Mosquito Lake Wetlands, and our geese just came back. Our Canada geese arrived yesterday, really. We have a pair of geese that think that they own this building and the wetlands around it, and here they are again. And so then the question is it time to put the peas in? And I'm not really sure. So we have some expertise with us. I'll start here in the studio with Leah Wagner, who's founder of Foundroot, an open pollinated seed company in Palmer. And so how does your garden grow?
Very slowly, Steve, very slowly.
But you're at the point of having starter plants indoors, wondering whether you can get them out pretty soon.
Yeah, they're happy right now, but they'll be pretty unhappy in a couple of weeks. So hopefully we'll start getting some warmer night temperatures and get them out in the soil sooner rather than later.
I ran across you at the Botanical Gardens Gardening Conference this year, and you're a student of Gary Paul Nabhan, who had actually was our guest earlier. And I was fascinated that you got caught up in his saving your seeds thing to the point where it's become an utter and complete passion and way of life.
It is, absolutely. It's definitely become a way of life for me. Gary he was one of the founders of Native Seed Search, which is a nonprofit down in Tucson who is collecting very old tribal varieties throughout the southwest of Mexico. And I went down to Native Seeds to do a seed saving course with them. And so I was able to meet Gary, see his home down in Patagonia, and be able to experience the work that he was doing down there.
And why would one get passionate about saving seeds?
Oh, that's a long conversation, Steve. I thought you wanted to talk about gardening.
Well, no, I mean, I'm not to the point of saving my seeds. I probably wouldn't even know whether my seeds were appropriate to save. You know, I wouldn't know, is this a hybrid? Mm-hmm. Can I tell from the package whether it's a hybrid? Or isn't it a big pain in the ass to save seeds? You have to let things go to seed. It just seems like really complicated. Gardening's complicated enough already.
It definitely is a process. I think the first step is just familiarizing yourself with seeds and feeling comfortable growing things from seed and not having to transplant all your vegetables. It's a lot less expensive. It's a lot more accessible. And there's many plants that don't want to be transplanted. So all those root crops, those should definitely come from seed packages, not transplants. But saving seeds is a way to reclaim our heritage. It's a way to reclaim our food security. Since 1903, we've lost 96% of the food varieties that were once available. We've honed down very few vegetables that we actually eat and grow today. And a lot of the heirlooms and heritage seeds that people are finding are actually better for a specific climate. So we've lost a lot of the history behind what was able to grow in challenging climates such as Alaska, and we've lost the knowledge that allows us to maintain a diversity in our vegetable supply.
Also joining us by telephone is Jeff Lowenfels, who is probably the longest-running garden columnist in the world, certainly in the United States. Jeff, welcome back to Talk of Alaska.
Well, always a pleasure, Steve. Absolutely important that we do save seeds, I think, in Alaska in particular, because we really have an opportunity to develop our own heirlooms, and we haven't really done it yet in Alaska. And by developing our own heirlooms, we'll get seeds that we can plant this time of the year, as opposed to waiting until the birch leaves get to the size of a squirrel's ear. So I think Leah's right onto something. Saving seeds, open pollinated, fabulous, only way to go. And Gary has an unbelievable facility down there in Tucson. If anybody gets a chance to go down and see it, they really should.
Really? So you've seen it too, huh?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they got a storage facility there that contains hundreds of thousands of seeds. And I thought one of the coolest things, they have the original corn plant. And I'll tell you what, it doesn't look like any corn plant I've ever seen. Absolutely fascinating place to go.
I thought it was the original corn plant was something called Teosinte. Is that right?
I think you're right.
That is. Yeah. That's absolutely
Leah's
what it
nodding.
Is.
Hey.
Yeah, there are these very interesting sort of triangular kernels, and Jeff's right. They look nothing like the corn that we see today.
Yeah, well, it sort of looks like, yeah, but maybe if you use your imagination a whole lot. But it kind of looks more like a grass almost.
Mm-hmm. Which
yeah.
corn
yeah,
is.
Absolutely.
It's one of those grains.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Jeff, it's great to have you on the show, and I want to open up the phone lines here very quickly at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org, and don't feel like you have to talk about saving seeds or anything like that. This is I've just assembled basically a panel for you to have a talk with, and I'm sure they'd like to hear your ideas as well as share their ideas and their knowledge with you. And in case you haven't tuned in to Jeff lately, I will tell you that he's gone beyond organic. He called it scientific gardening a few years ago, and now he just basically is talking about teeming, T-E-A-M-I-N-G, teeming with microbes. And now his new book coming out within a week. Is that right, Jeff? Teeming with Nutrients.
It comes out tomorrow. You can get it on Amazon, but it comes out tomorrow.
Really? So you're finally done with this. Now, teeming with microbes was essentially about kind of realizing your soil is living. That everything in there is living, and it's already got its own stuff going on. And you're better off encouraging that.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of the theme is no one fertilizes the redwoods with Miracle-Gro or sprays any kind of pesticides on them. How do they get to be 500 years old and 370 feet tall? Well, it's all the microbes and the soil food web organisms feeding the plant. We come along as gardeners, and we disrupt that system. So my book is about how to get back to the natural system, which makes gardening easier. And for many of us in Alaska who have lots of other things to do, that's a great thing to have, an easier way to garden.
Well, I was shocked at the AAAS this year of the amount of, first off, there was a whole lot about food security of every possible sort and stripe. There was stuff about fish farming. There was stuff about agronomy practices. There was stuff about meat or no meat. And it went on and on and on. But one thing that I really didn't think of as being food security at all was the session on microbes. But it turned out that it was mostly about food, about yield and resilience and being like drought hardy, salt hardy, and on like that. And they were using these terms.
Don't forget nutrition and higher Brix numbers, because you get much more better nutrition out of naturally grown food.
Yeah, and they were using words like phylosphere, endosphere, rhizosphere, and there was, this is like kind of a geography of the way microbes and plants are interacting. I mean, science has gotten interested in what you used to call scientific gardening, Jeff.
That's right. No, it's really taken over. I mean, and if you go to Amazon, teaming with microbes is 5,000 on the list right now. That's pretty good out of 7.5 million books on the Amazon list. So, yeah, people are into organic gardening. Organic gardening is soil food web gardening, and I think the seed saving helps just as well. I mean, it's all part of it.
Now, Leah, when you put your garden in your beds and so forth, you, I understand, are going by the permaculture method. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, permaculture is an ecological design system that it strives to work with nature rather than against it, and it has just some basic principles that is to care for the earth, care for the people, and to share the surplus. And there's a lot of methodology behind it, but it has everything to do with how you design your home, to how you're growing your food, and how you're engaging with the local community. And a lot of the methods that Jeff speaks about are definitely permaculture methods as well. There's a lot of crossover there. So we utilize no-till agriculture at our house, using things like sheet mulching, or a lot of people call it lasagna composting. We do red worm composting as well. We use that for compost tea. We try and decrease the amount of cost and the amount of labor input as much as possible.
You know, Jeff, I'm having a flashback to that show, wonderful show we did, where you and the compost tea lady down in Kodiak got so deep into compost tea, I had to rescue us all.
Right, and we're all still using it. I must say, it's spreading all over the country. There are a couple of cooperative extension service agents, one of whom has come to Alaska, who say it doesn't work. I'm here to tell you that's wrong. And every time they say there are no scientific studies, I always have to dig out 15 of them and send them out to them and have them read them. And it's crazy. But compost tea is all part of the system. It's all part of the microbes which permaculture uses. And really, people have really only gotten into the chemical side of gardening for the past 30 years or 40 years. We need to just stop it and go back to what we did before World War II ended, and we had to figure out what to do with all these munitions that contained high amounts of nitrogen.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about those how they are restoring prairie in some places, because they discovered that the places that they weren't using the, you know, where the fences were and things like that, there was still little bits of the prairie still hanging on there. And this was a colossal topsoil bank that was built up in this prairie. And I think people thought, well, you know, we can't, you know, this is an inexhaustible resource. It turns out it wasn't. But what is it? Where's the ecology that makes this prairie system with these grasses and this integrated structure of the soil so much superior to tilling the field, putting in the seeds, and yielding the crop?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. Part of the answer lies in a particular kind of microbe called mycorrhizal fungi. And the mycorrhizal fungi, for those who don't know, are associated with 90 to 96% of the plants on the planet Earth. In return for food from the plant, they get carbon from the plant in the root zone, in the rhizosphere. In return for that, they go out and get nitrogen, basically the metals and nitrogen, and bring it back to the plant, phosphorus, copper, zinc, and they also bring back water to the plant, and they are the major source of carbon input into the soil. So when you destroy them, which is what happens when you rototill and you put in that conventional kind of farming system, you don't get the building of soil structure. You don't get carbon added to the soil. You take carbon out of the soil because you're harvesting it all the time. So putting the prairie back makes a great deal of sense. By destroying them, we cause the terrible wind dust bowl problems of the 30s, and we still need to put that soil back. And so people are beginning to do that in the prairie system.
Well, here's the one that already came by email before the show, and it's because the guy really wanted to render out his what he was writing up. He really did a great job. Brian Box. And he says, so, I grew up with year-round gardens down in the lower 48, and since I moved up here to study biology at UAA, I've been trying to figure out how to bring a little bit of my green thumb out during the long winters here. After a year or so doing research, I put together an aquaponics garden in my garage. It takes care of a few things at once. The need to have a place to grow vegetables and my love of raising goldfish. The science is the fish exhale ammonia through their gills, and it's how they urinate. Ammonia is toxic to fish in high quantities, so along comes naturally occurring nitrifying bacteria called Nitrosomonas communis. Now, this nitrifying bacteria take that ammonia, convert the nitrogen into nitrates, NO3. The plants take up the nitrates, along with all the minerals and nutrients from the fish poo, after a detour through some earthworms, and I get a lovely little garden that has produced a ton of organic veggies. The fish are happy because their water's clean. The nitrifying bacteria, earthworms, and plants are happy because they have an endless supply of food. All it took was a few trips to the hardware store and a little bit of TLC. And now he's actually going to the point where he's going to the fish and game department and wants to gather the waste from hatcheries and start incorporating it into agriculture. Isn't that exciting? Isn't that amazing? I mean, this guy is just a student, and he's gone this deep into this.
Well, there's a wonderful book out by a woman named Sylvia Bernstein called Aquaponics. And she has designed systems for home gardeners, and they're terrific systems. I've done it. It's a wonderful way to go. The only thing people have to remember is it takes about 2 or 3 weeks before you can get the system working properly. So you get different amounts of ammonia at the beginning, and it takes a while for it to become the right kind of nitrogen, et cetera. But after 2 or 3 weeks, boom, you're there. So anybody who has a fish tank is actually doing aquaponics if it has plants in it. All you do with aquaponics is separate the plants out from the fish. So it's an aquarium system that's been broken up into two.
And Jeff, isn't it true that people are also able to do aquaponics where you're able to harvest the fish as well?
Oh, absolutely. In the big greenhouses, they grow tilapia, lots of different kinds of fish. I haven't heard anybody trying farm salmon on it, but absolutely. Ultimately, you're supposed to eat the fish as well as the food that you're growing as a result of the fish.
That's amazing. And also, when we talk about food security on the show, we pretty well run up against the barrier of seasonality that this emailer was bringing up. You know, we need ways that we can get production outside of just this short growing season we have. Leah, I'm assuming you've got lights.
Yes, we use a really simple setup that an architecture friend set up for us. He had the design. He actually was very interested in carnivorous plants, and so he was growing plants year round, and we decided to transfer that knowledge into vegetables. So we just use some simple shop lights and a baker's rack, and we alternate the bulbs with cool and warm lights, and it works great. It's very inexpensive, it's very simple, and we calculated that it's about 18 cents a day for the electricity.
Yeah, well, they're very I've known a lot of people out in the valley that are extremely literate about growing lights. It seems to be quite an issue for people out there. Our telephone number.
Yeah, I was just going to ask whether Leah's tried the new LED lights. They have some phenomenal LED lights now that are about 1 cent a day to run, and they've got a wavelength now. You put your finger underneath this light, and it will flower. they've really adjusted them to the point where you can get things to bloom. Of course, they're probably not designed for the food industry, but nonetheless, they work with the food industry, and they are spectacular. I highly encourage people to look into LED light systems.
There are awesome LEDs out there, and there's ones that are specific for growing food. Unfortunately, it's just more cost up front, which we didn't have the capacity for with the amount of plants that we're trying to grow, but that's definitely a hope for the future.
Right, right.
Well, our guests are Jeff Lowenfels and Leah Wagner. Leah is founder of Foundroot, an open-pollinated seed company, and I'd say kind of a sustainability campaign out of Palmer. And Jeff is the nation's longest-running garden columnist and author of Teeming with Microbes and Teeming with Nutrients, which is actually out tomorrow. We're talking about gardening options, and your calls are welcome at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. I have an inexhaustible reservoir of my own questions and curiosities, you know, because I'm a gardener. And I think every gardener is that way. They get together with other gardeners, and pretty soon they're right down to the total nuts and bolts of whatever it is that they're talking about, and why did this do that, and no, it didn't do that for me, and maybe you ought to try this, and so we can really get inside baseball really quickly here, and we're really happy to have your participation, because it's time to start making some choices and some decisions, and I'm particularly intrigued with this seed saving option. I don't even know where to start. I mean, where would I start? Would I start with you? Would I go to you and say, "Would you give me some snow peas that I'll be able to save the seeds of, and then we can swap later?" How?
Absolutely. All the seeds that we sell are open pollinated, which means that you can collect the seeds from every single variety that we sell. If we don't sell a variety that you're looking for, you can always go to a regular seed company and just look for OP or open pollinated. A lot of open pollinated seeds are referred to as heirlooms, and those are just much older open pollinated seeds. They're seeds with a story behind them. So, yeah, that would be the first place to start, is just purchasing some open pollinated seeds. And from there, you just need some basic knowledge about pollination. But the easiest place to start would be with any vegetable that has a perfect flower. So I usually suggest that people start with something like a tomato, a pepper, a lettuce, or a pea. And those are much easier varieties to start with because all the pollination is happening right inside one flower. And if you choose to just grow one type of each of those varieties, just one pea this year, then you know that that seed will be pure, it'll be stable, it'll definitely be the plant that you intended on collecting. It won't be crossed with something else, and then you'll have pea seeds for next year.
But don't you have to keep them in a special situation during the winter time so they don't? Do you put them in the refrigerator? Do you put them in a can with one of those little dryer things in it? How do you store yours?
Well, first you need to dry them. So ideally they'll dry right on the pod. If you have a wet climate or an early frost, you can pull the entire plant, turn it upside down, and actually put a paper bag over it and put it in a warm, dry place. So if you have a garage that stays pretty warm, you can just hang the entire plant right above the roots, and any seeds that drop will be caught by the bag, and then after that you can clean out those pods, and those peas that you would have eaten are your seeds.
That sounds so simple.
It is. It's terribly simple. And then from there, you want to store those seeds in you want to store them under 45 degrees in a dry space. And so a lot of times I just suggest that people put them in a mason jar in the fridge or the freezer. And that's a nice controlled environment. That's actually how most seed banks are storing their seeds. And as of right now, unless you're dealing with some sort of special seed or tropical seed, it's completely fine to freeze those seeds.
It's fine to freeze them. That answers my question. You know, I was right. Some seeds have to freeze, right?
Right.
That's the vernalization process, exactly. And so with that, that actually has more to do with the plant than the seed itself. So that plant needs to go through a cold period that, well, in our case, it's not really mimicking winter. It's actually winter.
Yeah.
But you want to put it through that cold spell. So biennial seeds, so plants that don't produce seed the first year but produce it the second year, know that winter has happened and it's time to produce that seed. For us, our biggest challenge is overwintering plants, and therefore we usually will have to pull those plants out and keep them in a less cold place, root storage, et cetera, and then replant them in the spring. So if you are in a warmer space, like down in Homer, they're able to overwinter kale. In Southeast Alaska, they've definitely had some successes with overwintering plants that we might not be able to do in South Central.
I want to switch back to fish just for a second, because Brian chimed in by email saying, just so the public knows, it is illegal to eat a fish that's grown in an aquaponic system in Alaska, which is interesting. So you don't want to get busted for it if you're doing it. You have to observe proper confidentiality.
So, Brian, please don't be eating your goldfish. We don't want you to get in trouble.
Wait a minute. You mean it's illegal for me to eat a fish that I grow in the privacy of my home? That's baloney.
Well, no, it's a fish.
No, I think it's probably illegal for you to sell the fish for somebody else to eat.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just that's an email. It could be totally wrong. I don't really know. But, I just... I just saying discretion might be advised. Let's go to, I just found out that the phones were down for a second, and now they're back up, and the telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, and all of a sudden there's a whole stack of calls here. Let's go to Gazelle in Juneau. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Leah Wagner and Jeff Lowenfels. Gazelle.
Hi, it's Gazelle. And I'm calling for Leah down in Juneau. She knows me.
Hi, Giselle.
I have a question. I've been meaning to get seeds from you. And Cliff and I are living on a sailboat this summer and don't obviously have a garden. We have a dock. But we want to know what we can grow this summer on the boat rather than actually having a garden to plant in.
So many fabulous things. Actually, a lot of the varieties that we sell are dwarf varieties because they're going to mature a lot faster and a lot sooner. And dwarf varieties do great in containers. So I would say most anything besides squashes, because that takes up a lot of space, you can definitely do in container planting. There's amazing resources on square foot gardening, which is how to grow in really small spaces. One of my favorite books is How to Grow More Vegetables. I believe it's Than You've Ever Imagined in Less Space. it's a long title, but it talks about growing things in very small spaces. And so as long as you have some 5-gallon buckets, you drill some holes in the bottom and fill them with really nutritious, great organic compost and possibly some perlite to aerate it. And you can cut it with a little bit of peat moss or rotted leaves, then you'll have a really nice space to grow that food in. The tomato that we're growing this year is the whippersnapper, and it actually does best in hanging baskets. Peas, salad greens, you can grow in long rectangular containers. The list goes on. Most everything you can grow in a small space. You just have to make sure that it has enough soil to grow in.
Thank you.
Hey, Giselle, I should tell you, this is Jeff Lohenfeld. The very first plant I ever grew were tomatoes on a boat. My first garden was on a boat. So, you know, there's no question it can be done. You have to be careful that people don't come along when you're not on the boat and pick your tomatoes for you.
Yeah. You'll have to watch out.
Thanks, Giselle.
Thanks.
All right, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org. Before I go to another call and an email that's sitting here burning, whippersnapper, tell me about it.
Oh, I love it so much. It's a great little tomato.
Is this a Siberian or?
This one's not. This one, our seed stock came from upstate New York, and it was a variety that I had tried. My mentor is Bill McDorman, who's actually the executive director of Native Seeds, and he at one time owned a company called Seeds Trust that was grown at 6,000 feet in Montana. And so he is an amazing resource for cold climate seeds. And the whippersnapper seeds originally came from his company, and they grow these nice little pink grape tomatoes. They're just covered with flowers, and they're a very strange plant because they're really sprawling, and so they don't really work as well in a garden bed as they do in a container or hanging basket because they kind of fall over the side. And we had really great success with them without any plastic, nothing over them. They ripened outside, which was extraordinary. So
I'm astounded.
Yeah, I was astounded too. We're trying a lot of different tomato varieties, and that's the one that we've had the most success with and would work really well for the diverse gardens that exist in Alaska.
So if I had those seeds, should I have had them started already? Yes.
So long ago, yes. quite a while ago. Yeah, our tomatoes are actually going up into larger pots now.
Jeff.
But it sounds to me like you could start yours now, Steve, and bring them inside, because this particular variety is small enough to be able to be moved. And so, yeah, you might not get all the fruit you want by late August, but you can grow them inside under lights.
I think that's a great idea, and as long as you have a sunny, south-facing window, that should work fine. Our biggest problem is losing that light too soon. So.
Right, right. It's the quickness of the light change that really gets us, not the temperature problems.
Lighting augmentation is a good option to examine in Alaska. This one's from Mark Masteller, who chimes in on this. He always loves the sustainability stuff, you know, and he says we need two things here to improve our food security. One, use our huge amount of stranded renewable energy for local food production in remote areas. Yes! And then also, how about this one here? Community-supported cold storage. On the concept of community-supported agriculture, what is cold storage?
So you go to somebody
else's root cellar, and they try and find room for your stuff.
That's a fabulous idea.
Yeah, it really is. You know, because plenty of people have community gardens, and the reason why they're out there, they don't have enough room for themselves. They have an apartment. Yeah, what a terrific idea.
Okay, let's start in with the calls here. Deb joins the program from Fairbanks. And Deb, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a garden that's been dormant for about 12 years.
Oh, you're lucky. You're a lucky devil.
I gardened for about 20 years. how do I reestablish that there's grass and other plants? How can I reestablish that without rototilling? And I'll hang up. For
all right.
Answer.
Yeah, this is one. This Jeff is going to be all over this one.
Yeah, I like this one. What I would do is, let's see, up in Fairbanks, I would take 12 sheets of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, 12 sheets thick, and cover the entire garden beds, all of the beds, or if it's just one bed, cover it up. And then I'd do the little bit of lasagna mulching, throw on some compost, throw on grass clippings, et cetera, and I'd plant right in it. And by the end of the season, everything will have decayed down. All the grass and everything should be dead down below. This is a system that's been developed by a guy named Lee Reich, who's come up and spoke a couple of times up in Anchorage at the Botanical Garden. You could take a bed of lawn, and put on 12 sheets of newspaper and then pile compost and soil on top of that and just plant right there. And by the end of the season, you'll have a permanent garden bed with no grass underneath it. Easy way to go. Very easy way to go. And I would not rototill because you destroy the soil food web when you do that.
Jeff, do you prefer to use newspaper versus cardboard?
Well, I would use cardboard. The thing I worry about cardboard is Chinese cardboard contains bad chemicals. Mm-hmm. And so unless you know it's American cardboard, you know, you've got a little iffy situation. I know the Anchorage Daily News and the Fairbanks News Miner are healthy papers, so to speak. But you could use cardboard, and then you don't have to use all that paper, so.
And just to add, I would throw some really great manure on there if you know anyone with goats, chickens, or non-medicated horses. Definitely stick that into your sheet mulch.
Well, I thought you were going to say throw the Anchorage Daily News garden column on there. That's enough manure.
We already know that, Jeff. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage of state government since 1991. On the web at akbudgetreport.com.
Talk of Alaska, and what a fun conversation. But it is sort of all over the place, and Scott just chimes in by email and says, hey, change the subject. We don't want to talk about saving seeds. Talk about the stuff that we can do now. That's a fall thing. That's the input from Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
All right.
Well, you know, it's not necessarily just a fall thing. I mean, on your perennials, if you haven't cut yours back, you can go collect seeds right now, and a lot of those will be viable. So it's not just in the fall.
I have enough curly dock seeds in my yard alone to populate the entire city of Anchorage.
That's good. It is a planning process, though. You need to make sure that what you set up in your garden actually allows you to save those seeds. So although you're not actively saving those seeds right now, if you intend on doing it, it is something that you'd like to plan for now. And we include seed saving in dividing perennials, grafting trees. You don't have to wait till the fall.
Wow.
No, you don't. Hey, I want to go back to that call in Fairbanks, because I think you and I talked yesterday, Steve, about this. The only real take-home message in my second book, although it's got great science and it'll tell people stuff they really need to know, is we need to test our soils in order to be sustainable. It's a funny thing. Almost no gardener in America
has ever tested their garden soils. Yeah, they may test it for pH occasionally, but they don't test it for NPK and the other nutrients. There are only 17 of them that plants need, but they don't and 14 of them are testable, but they don't test them for that. And if we want to be sustainable, then we should be putting down on our gardens only what our gardens need, instead of having the knee-jerk reaction of just going out and buying fertilizer in the spring and throwing it down whether the garden needs it or not, and whether it's the right kind or not, which is
I got so many paper bags hanging full of seeds in my garage. I didn't have room for a mass spec. How are you going to analyze your soil, Jeff?
Well, what you do is you get a sample of it and you send it to a soil lab. There's one up in Palmer. I like the Kinsey Lab, K-I-N-S-E-Y. They'll test your soil. And not only will they test your soil, but they'll tell you exactly what you should be putting on in order to grow the kinds of things that you want to grow. So it really is a very important thing to do. We are running out of phosphorus in this country. You can no longer find phosphorus in lawn foods in most states in this country. It is now not allowed because we're running out of it, believe it or not. We're almost at peak phosphorus. So we really need to start testing in order to be sustainable. We're throwing way too many chemicals down on our gardens and in our yards, just knee-jerk, without testing the soils. And we really need to do that. We need to start making that a priority in gardening. And you only have to do it, you know, the first year, then you might do it again, maybe the second, the third year to see how things are trending, and that's all you really need to do.
So what? Is there a website I can go to? Can Cooperative Extension help me out with this? I mean...
Yeah. Just look up Soil Testing Alaska. You'll get the lab that's up in Palmer, or you can go to Kinsey, K-I-N-S-E-Y Labs, and find them. It usually costs anywhere from $20 to $30 or $40, which sounds like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money, but on the other hand, if we want to be sustainable, we got to spend the money and do it the right way. You will end up saving money in the long run and having, I believe, a much better garden. People don't realize when you throw down the wrong kinds of fertilizers, sometimes you interfere with how your plant grows. You don't help it grow.
Yeah. Let's go to Gordon, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Gordon.
Hi. Hello, Jeff and Leah.
Yes, sir.
I think I met Leah at one of the garden fairs selling the seeds last year, and I've known Jeff for a long time.
Yeah, she tells me that Leah tells me that she's going to be doing the farmer's market thing again this year.
We will be, yes.
So I got a question about growing wild seeds. I want to grow more native wildflowers, and whenever I'm out on a hike, I'd like to grab some seeds rather than dig up a whole plant. And I've been having very little success. I've tried monk's hood, delphinium, some wild geranium, lupin, and the only thing that I could get to germinate over the last couple of years is lupin.
Well, you're ahead of me.
Yeah, lupin was definitely going to be my first suggestion. That's a very common garden flower. Unfortunately, I'm a vegetable person, not a flower person. I don't know if Jeff can speak to this at all.
Sure. Well, you know, I think what a lot of people don't realize is that these seeds do need to be vernalized, which means they need to have a cold treatment in order to trigger germination. What I do with the things that I collect out in the wild is I plant them in a little nursery bed that I have outside. I don't even bring them inside. I emulate what happens in the wintertime in Alaska by having them go through a winter in Alaska outside. So you might want to just take the seeds, if they're viable, of course, and put them into your soil, into containers. Keep them outdoors. Don't ever bring them inside, and have them grow just like they would out in nature.
That makes perfect sense. And also just be mindful that they're really completely dry, because any mold, any type of fungus on them will prevent them from germinating. And also just do a little bit of research. Look up the pollination for those types of plants. A lot of plants are dioecious, and so they need to have male and female plants around to be able to pollinate and have viable seeds. So just doing a little bit of research on those types of flowers and making sure that you have enough of both types of seed to make them viable in the future.
Yeah, and I would not plant in compost. I would try to get natural soil. And if you can get a little bit of the natural soil from the area where the plants themselves are growing, then you're going to ensure that you have the right mycorrhizal fungi and microbes, other microbes, to feed that plant as it's going. And, in fact, maybe even to make it germinate. Sometimes this fungi is required for germination.
Gordon?
Okay. I've done the cold treatment, and that, but I didn't use native soil. I used my own.
And did you do it outside or did you do it in the refrigerator?
I did both.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe I'm just finding monkshood seeds that haven't been properly pollinated out in the wild. So just the luck of the draw, maybe.
Keep trying, though, Gordon. It's very cool what you're doing.
Absolutely. And you might want to try going a little bit later in the season because they may not be viable seeds at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, they're a hard one to catch because when they're mature, then they fall out of the pod.
Right.
So
right.
If you find a pod full of seeds, they may not be mature enough yet.
Exactly.
If you have secret spot or if you have some on your own land, you can always put a little paper bag when they're near dry, and so that way you can catch those seeds and you know that they'll be fully mature. Because once they drop, those are the perfect seeds.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely, yeah. Go get them, Gordon.
Okay. I'll keep trying.
All right. Thanks, Gordon.
Good luck to you.
It's a very, very interesting challenge there. This one from George Ann, Alaska Community Action on Toxic has a compost workshop June 5th. More information on our organic gardening workshops can be found at www.akaction. That's Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
And very important that people compost. Another take home of the second book is there's something called the law of return. What falls down under from a plant is supposed to do that and stay there. And of course, we come along and we clean everything up. Well, that's not the way you're supposed to take care of plants. Leave the stuff there. Compost is a good way to do it.
But yet, as you were just telling Gordon, compost is not necessarily what you want for a wild plant.
Not necessarily for a wild plant, but on your own property, when your leaves fall down, they're making natural compost underneath the plants. Well, so if you're using the stuff from your property, on your property, then you're probably emulating what it needs.
Well, that's a good lead into Greg from Juneau, I think. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Greg.
Well, I have a couple of questions, a short one on top. Using chopped up styrofoam as replacement for perlite for your soil expansions to help the roots. And the second question, a little different, is using different things in your composts for heat generating. The high potassium type soils like coffee grounds or bone meal, when you put it in there, it'll heat your ground temperature up, which is critical in Alaska in starting things out. But how you time that so you get the most heat.
Wow.
Well, you got two questions there.
All right, the first one's easy, isn't it, Jeff?
Yeah.
Yeah, never. Don't
please
do
please don't ever do that.
Don't do it. I mean, well, it does. It never breaks down, and that stuff also contains all sorts of things you don't want in your system. And so little teeny bits of it might leach out and get into your system, but it takes 10,000 years to break that stuff down. It is terrible. I always have a panic when I get something in the mail. It's full of those little styrofoam things, you know. I open up the box outside because I don't want the things falling, and then I have my own little Exxon Valdez styrofoam. You know,
break down in the soil, how could it possibly leach into the soil?
It breaks down.
that's a conflict in terms.
Sounds like you need to read Jeff's book, sir.
That's an idea. I don't know if it'd be the best thing for things that are edible, but, you know, for trees and your garden, shrubs, things of that nature, I hadn't heard that there was any measurable leaching of that. But,
yeah, but our panel's not.
I'm more concerned about the heat-generating phosphates, such as putting phosphorus coffee grounds or bone meal in the soil, which will raise the temperature of your ground soil.
Well, it's not as good as green things will. Grass clippings, straw, things that contain sugar will raise the temperature even more. The bone meal does increase a little bit of the microbial activity, but if you really want to heat up the soil, use alfalfa meal.
Yeah, I've heard that about alfalfa.
Yeah.
You got to work with a lot of good minerals and trace elements in that. Back to sugar, isn't there a little concerned about mold and fungus when you put that sugar in there? We got enough of that here. I'm wondering how you would counteract that effect.
Nope. You don't. You know, the sugars are what the bacteria feed on, and it's the bacteria that increase the heat. It's their metabolism that causes the heat. So feeding sugar to the bacteria is what causes compost piles to heat up and things like alfalfa, et cetera, to heat up.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, Greg. Thanks. Thanks for that. I really enjoy that type of conversation. That's that. As a radio listener, I just like it when it gets all messy like that. let's go to Sherry in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Sherry.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
I have been composting worms for several years, and in my worm, because I have difficult time composting outside, that I, you know, put all my compostable garbage in the worm bin, I have a huge collection of the stuff that comes in the bottom of it, which is sort of, I wouldn't call it worm tea. It's more like worm oil or worm glop. It's a very thick, thick liquid, and I don't know what to do with it. I have tried using it as a fertilizer. It's, unless extremely, extremely diluted, it just burns things up. And so I have probably gallons of this stuff. What is a safe thing to do with it? I don't want to just throw it on the ground outside because I think it'll kill things.
No, I love that stuff. It's actually a worm leachate. And, you know, funny, I've never had any trouble using mine straight. But dilution certainly... Yeah, dilution certainly is a solution if you've been having problems. They used to sell a product that in recyclable bottles that you could spray on. I don't think we have it anymore. These kids made the Wall Street Journal because they used the same label colors as Miracle-Gro, and so they became quite famous. But you can dilute that stuff and use it. It's wonderful. It's got some great microbes in it, and I've never had any problem using it straight. It's great on compost piles, I have to tell you that, because it really puts some good organics into the compost pile, and the microbes really love this stuff. But again, I would go back and try it straight again to see how you do it, particularly on perennials. I've never had any problems, but give it a try.
You can also be mindful of how much liquid you're actually putting in your worm bin, because we don't have a lot of liquid coming out of the bottom of ours. We're just really mindful to not put too much liquid waste in there. So we put mainly firm matter into our worm bin. So it's another option if you really don't feel like you can use it on your plants. Also just being mindful not to get it on any of the leaves and the plant itself, but just putting it on the soil.
Okay. And the old stuff, I mean, I've got some that's probably 5 years old.
Yeah. You've been sitting in the bin for 5 years?
No. I've put it in plastic jars, but I've got this huge collection of it because I didn't know what to do with
it. Sure. Yeah. Well, now that stuff may have gone anaerobic, so I would certainly open those jars up and let it breathe for a little bit before I used it. If it smells bad, it is anaerobic, and I would throw it away.
I'm loving it. Thank you so much, Sherry, for that call. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. Alaskan educators can earn a master's degree in educational leadership, special education, and more from the University of Alaska Southeast. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
It's Talk of Alaska. We've got Leah Wagner and Jeff Lowenfels with us, and we're going through gardening options, and it's a fast-moving show. This email from Scott, I think this one's for you, Jeff, or either one of you could handle it, though. When you do the lasagna method, so you have the newspaper layers, how thick should the compost layer be on top of that?
Well, if you're going to plant right in it, I make it at least 12 inches, and if you can go 18 to 24, so much the better.
Whoa. All right.
Yeah, it's a lot of soil, but you want to garden right away. I mean, if you want to wait, you don't have to put that much stuff on, but you won't be able to garden right away.
And to Mark in Fairbanks, welcome to Talk of Alaska, Mark.
Oh, yeah. I know we've been talking about soils and seeds and like that, but I have chickweed issues.
We all have chickweed issues. You're not alone. We all have them.
No, we don't. No, chickweed is caused by excessive nitrogen. And so if you have too much nitrates in your soil, you're going to get chickweed. And the answer to it is, first of all, go organic, and second of all, mulch. If you mulch, there are no bare soils in nature. And if you mulch, you prevent light from getting to those seeds, and you prevent them from coming up. I'll tell you another thing that causes chickweed, rototilling. There are people now in the lower 48 states who are rototilling, if they have to, at night, so that they don't get light germinating to germinate the seeds. Pretty amazing. Just your lights from your tractor will cause these seeds to germinate.
But I'm surprised. Thank you.
All right, Mark. I'm loving it. It's turning into the Hardy Boys here. It's Talk of Alaska. Let's go to Shelley. Joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Shelley.
Hi, and thank you. Yes, I've been using the compost from the Burroughs waste treatment plant for a few years on my flowers, and it works really well. And I wondered what if they knew anything about it and the safety of it for using it on your food plants.
Well, I think there's a heavy metal concern. That's as much as I know.
Well, I would certainly ask the city to test the stuff and have the U.S. Composting Council give a comment about how the stuff turns out as a result of the test. But I would be a little bit leery. Who knows what's going into that compost? And there have been bad problems.
They do testing on it. They don't just release it without doing testing on each new batch. But is Fairbanks the only borough that does that? Sells that?
Well, you know, we're not selling it down in the Anchorage area, although it is being made in Anchorage in several different places. But, you want to take a look at those tests very carefully. And Steve's right. Heavy metals is one of the problems. You can get antibiotics, all sorts of stuff. So I think twice about using it in my vegetable garden. I don't know. What do you think, Leah?
I wouldn't. It makes me nervous. Also, I would ask them what their intention is with it, too. If they don't intend for it to be for food use and it's meant for just lawn use, then I would definitely strictly adhere to that because people make a particular point if something is able to be used for edibles.
Right.
Well, I have asked them, and they do say that it's perfectly safe for food, that they do test it, but I guess how would I go about searching further for testing than just the burrow?
What about doing the test that Jeff mentioned? What do you think about that?
Yeah, you could probably send it out. Yeah. Yeah, okay. And tell him where it came from, and then he'll adjust his test to make sure you get the right answer.
All right. Yeah, thanks for that. Very, very informative. This one from Dennis Harrison Juno saying, here in rain country, we battle soil acidity. My downtown Juno lawn soil is always acid, no matter how much dolomite I use, because of nearby spruce trees, copper or iron sulfite only temporarily kills moss in my lawn. I've been fertilizing the organic lawn with alfalfa meal and compost tea, but moss keeps coming back. What can I do, Jeff?
Yeah, well, moss is a fact of life in Alaska. You know, we've come to the assumption that we can have green lawn, but in fact, that lawn is eventually going to turn back to moss. It's just the nature of our soils. And once you have the moss, unless you kill it and then fertilize, you're just feeding the moss. And so if you don't kill it and remove it, you're always going to have it.
You got that?
Now,
you got that, Dennis? Kill it. Okay, and also...
Personally, moss is a great thing to have for a lawn. It's green, it's soft, and it doesn't need much water.
Don't fight the nature.
A moss lawn. Well, Dennis also wants you to know that he hopes to republish his mom's Color and Rain Country Flower Gardening book next year.
Oh, terrific book, terrific book.
As print on demand.
Nancy
in Anchorage, welcome to Talk of Alaska, Nancy.
Yes, thank you. I have two quick questions.
Good. That's all the time we got, so it's quick.
Hey, I have some fir cones in the fridge. You reminded me. Should I start them between damp paper towels, or should I start them directly in some soil? I know you touched on this.
What do you think?
Sorry, you said fir cones?
Yeah, they're fir cones. I want to start some little fir seedlings.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, you could start them in paper towels. How large are the seeds themselves?
Oh, they're just, you know, a little quarter inch long attached to the scale.
Right.
Small.
Yeah, you could, or you could start them in growing medium. I don't think it really makes a difference either way. The seed, when it starts, actually has all the material in it. It has all the nutrients it needs up until it gets about, we usually say up to the first true leaf. So past those cotyledons, those initial sprout leaves, and going into those first two leaves. So you have quite some time before it actually needs all that nutritious matter in the potting soil.
Right.
I personally just don't like moving my plants. They don't like to be handled that much. And so I would start them in a pot in some sort of medium, personally.
Okay.
Yeah, I would too, but I would also Google it because the viability of those seeds is very short. So you have to make sure that you're planting them at the right time vis-a-vis when you got the cones themselves.
Okay, I'll do that. Then the other quick question is, what cheap organic mulch can you recommend? Because straw has sprouted on me, and I understand that wood chips can draw nutrients out of the soil when they decompose.
We use forest waste.
That's a great way to go, but I don't agree that the stuff will – it'll pull nutrients out of the soil in just a teeny little zone, about a quarter of an inch where the stuff is, so you don't have to worry about that. What you have to worry about is green goes onto the annuals and brown mulches on the perennials and things that stay in the ground for more than a year.
Okay, the wood chips seem to breed slug practically, though. That's the other problem I've had with wood chips.
Well, then you got to get rid of the slugs, and the way to do that is you put the traps, whether they're beer traps or commercial traps, outside of your garden. Too many people put them in the garden, and these guys will travel a mile a night to get into that trap. Well, you want to make the trap outside of the garden. Don't attract all your neighbor's slugs into your garden.
Okay, thanks for the advice.
Okay. On the newspaper method, Michelle says, hey, wait a minute, there's ink on those newspaper pages. Isn't that dangerous?
Soy ink.
But not anymore.
Yeah.
Soy ink.
It's soy ink, and actually, newspaper is some of the most sterile and safe material around, so it's a great free resource. It's awesome in your garden. You can also germinate your seeds on them. Newspaper's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. And this one from Liz Blumink over at DNR saying, hey, I haven't heard anybody mention, it's Alaska Agriculture Day today.
Hey, yay. Whoopee, come on,
that's awesome.
I didn't even know. Thanks, Liz. So Leah, the found root, do you actually have a store or anything, or do you just do
farmers? No, we do mainly online sales, and then we do events, conferences. We've done a bunch of workshops, and then we'll be at the farmer's market for the beginning of the season. So we'll be at the Spinard Farmer's Market for about the first 3 or 4 weeks, and then we'll be at the Friday Fling as well.
Okay, and Jeff,
what's the website?
www.foundroot.com.
And Jeff, I assume we're going to see your book any day now.
You can order it on Amazon right now, and I highly encourage people to do so. And I'll be out on the Botanical Garden on May 25th signing them.
All right. Well, great to have both of you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you,
Steve.
And thanks to all the great callers, man. So much fun. Next week, it's Christine Bile, a trail cutter, lives up by Denali, and is author of Dirt Work. You're going to enjoy this lady. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage of state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. Start a second career. Earn a Master's of Arts and teaching degree from the University of Alaska Southeast, from home or on campus. Registration information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at alaskapublic.org. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.